During the coffee break, we have had quite a number of questions from you with regards to some of the things we've said this morning, but particularly this introvert-extrovert thing. Apparently this is an open nerve with some of you. And so we want to just say a few more things about it. Most of us are not extremists when it comes to these differences. Like I said last night, when Carol and I first got married, we were like this on this perfection fast thing. But in other areas of difference, we're not that far apart. We are somewhere sort of down the road, but we have preferences. All of us have preferences as the way we operate in many of these areas, which are different than the preferences that our spouses have. And this manifests itself in many different ways. And this extrovert-introvert thing, for instance, has become with us we have blended as time has gone by. I have learned from Carol, and she has learned from me. For instance, Carol now finds that she needs time alone. And it's not infrequent that I will find her upstairs in her little study with the door shut by herself because she just needs a little time for reflection. Now, I need that more than she does. And she needs people more than I do. But we've discovered, and as we have done reading on this, that as time goes by and we are really open and we are learning, our extremes seem to modify themselves. And we do become more like each other or closer to each other. And of course, oftentimes our jobs force us to learn some new things about that. That's been true with me. I mean, the jobs that I've had for the last 25 years in the Navigators, I have had to force myself to be more outgoing, to be more of an extrovert in certain kinds of situations. And of course, living with Carol has forced me to do that at times, which has been good for me. See, I've learned, I've grown as a result of that, and vice versa. I mean, this thing manifests itself in so many different ways. For instance, the introvert-extrovert thing manifests itself between the two of us, even in the way we start our day. Such a little thing as that. I am usually up before Carol is. And I get my bathrobe on, my slippers on, I plod downstairs, put a pot of coffee on, and then get a cup and go over and sit on the couch in the family room, and I just sit there, drinking my coffee and getting awake and contemplating the day and thinking about what's going to happen and, very quiet. And then after my second cup of coffee, I'll pick up my Bible and begin to read a little and have some time with the Lord and pray. And about that time, I hear Carol get up. Our bedroom is right above where I'm sitting, and the floor squeaks. And so I can hear her when she hits the floor. And from the time her feet hit the floor, it is a flurry of activity. I mean, it is go, go, go. She gets up. She makes the bed. She does her exercises. She gets her makeup on. She gets dressed. And then, after, a half hour of all that, then she'll go in and have her quiet time with the Lord. But, I mean, we just start the day differently because of the way we're wired together inside. Not wrong, just different, huh? Carol's got some thoughts on this also.
Jack and I, last November, had the privilege of being in Singapore and East Malaysia on a ministry trip. We hit East Malaysia very tired after 4 or 5 weeks in Singapore and other places. Both of us got off the airplane exhausted. The couple that met us in, what city was that?
Kuching,
which is Borneo. This is the island of Borneo. Okay, I've heard about Borneo all my life, never been to Borneo. And the couple that met us wanted immediately to take us to a museum and show us the museum. Jack goes, I could just hear him going, I'm thinking, we're both exhausted, but I'm thinking, I could not miss going to that. I've heard of Borneo all my life, which even though we were tired physically, see, the going to that museum and seeing that before a seminar that night energized me. Jack had to go and sleep, and I had to understand that he needed to do that. So this is how you can kind of tell. When I'm depressed, as an extrovert, what do? Well, I go get my hair done. I have lunch with a friend. I go do something, activity. When Jack is depressed, he'll go get some time alone, take a walk, so on. So it comes out in a lot of little ways. Has nothing to do, by the way, with being able to relate to people. In fact, our little grandson, we feel, is an extrovert. When, by age two, whenever he had any time, he wanted to be with you. Quieter than Sonny, but he had to be with you. To this day, he does. And it was always, play with me, Grandma. Would you play with me, Grandma? But our little granddaughter, who is actually more outgoing sometimes, is, we feel, an introvert. She has to have her time alone playing, or she gets really crabby. So it has to do with that capacity. I can go lots longer with people than Jack can, and before he has to retreat. And we just have to understand that about each other. It doesn't mean that we don't switch over all the time. In fact, we talk about it now. Jack, when he goes to certain places, he pushes his E button. That's his extrovert button. And he can be just as outgoing as anybody. And I'm the one that has to simmer down. So, any questions on that? Okay. We're always going back and forth. You want me to say it? Oh, yeah, okay. Before Jack continues on the matter of differences, I was asked to say something about the books that we have down there. Some of you may want to buy one of our books for babysitter or Christmas gifts and so on. And so let me just say, we will be down there. If you want us to sign them, we'll be down there after lunch at the bookstore, outside of the bookstore. We'll be happy to sign them for you. Now, the books that are available, the ones that I have written, is the first one is Lord of My Rocking Boat. If the boat of your life is rocking, that may be a little book that you would like to pick up. The next one, those of you who have trouble with your tongue, you won't want to buy it. And those that don't have trouble with your tongue, you won't need it. So it's called Words That Heal, Words That Hurt. So just don't buy that one. But you may know somebody that you think might need it. My latest is Help, Lord, My Whole Life Hurts. And if you have someone you feel that their life is falling apart, that might be a book that you'd like to pick up with them. The two, of course, that we have written together, as Susan mentioned, is Marriage Takes More Than Love, and that's sort of the basics that we're giving you here, and then Opposites Attack. So we'll be down there after lunch from 12:45 to maybe 1:15, and be happy to sign them if you want us.
Someone has said that in your younger days when you're married, maybe not even when you're married, but in your younger days, the responsibility that we have is to learn who you are, to learn who we are, find out who we are. And then as we get toward middle age, to become the other side of that person, to grow in those areas where we'll expand our horizons. And we found this to be true in our own lives, that as we have gotten older, our extreme positions have modified because we have been open to learn and we want to grow. And, of course, we're just slightly, not very much, but just slightly past middle age now. And we hope that we will never stop growing. We want to continue to grow in our lives. And I trust that that would be true of all of you. Well, let me try and summarize in four words what we have been talking about here. And these are the words: knowing, understanding, adjusting, and accepting. And if you walk out of this session and don't remember anything else, if you remember these four words, and once a week apply them to some situation, this session will have been well worthwhile. Knowing. Carol quoted from that pastor's wife. study your man as though he were some wild and fascinating creature, which he is. That's what we're talking about here. To stand back and observe, study that person to whom you are married. Observe how they do things and how they do things differently than you do. Really make a study of it. Don't just drift through life not making these kinds of observations in your marriage. But we got to go beyond that. The second word is understanding, and understanding goes beyond knowing because it involves getting inside of the other person. It involves the why. It's not just knowing what they do the way they do it, but why they do what they do the way they do it. And in order for us to really understand another person, at least two ingredients must be plugged in. Number one, we've got to communicate. We've got to talk. We've got to draw one another out. We've got to get inside the mind and heart of the other person in order for us to really understand them. We've got to get to why they did what they did the way they did it. And the only way you can do that is talk to each other on a pretty in-depth level. The second thing that we feel is important for understanding is prayer. The verse that Carol mentioned in James 1:5, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally, and it shall be given him. We need to ask the Lord for wisdom to understand that very complex, complicated person to whom we are married. There is no way humanly that we're going to be able to do that. We need help from God. And God is the one who has wired them together the way they are. So he's got some insights for us, if we're willing to take just a little bit of time and ask him for those insights. So that's understanding. Adjusting, of course, we've been talking about that. Change is the name of the game, I said. And we've got to be willing to make adjustments as we go along. And it's a two-way street. And then, fourthly, accepting. There are some things that we cannot change. The fact of the matter is, that is the way we are. There is a very fine line, however, between expecting to be accepted and not using it as an excuse for failing to change. It's a very fine line there. And we need to be careful about our motivations when we're in that process. And there again, I believe that God can help us on that and help reveal to us. The scripture says that it's like a sharp two-edged sword piercing even to the dividing asunder of soul and spirit and joints and marrow. It's a discerner of the thoughts and the intents of the heart. And that's what we're dealing with here sometimes. It's the thoughts and the intents of the heart. And so we need God's help on that. So those four words, knowing, understanding, adjusting, and accepting. Now let me tell you a story that incorporates all four of those, just to kind of cement it to your mind. Several years ago, Carol and I had been down in Florida for 2 weeks on a ministry trip, the early part of January. And it had really been a long 2 weeks of exhaustion. Probably a little bit more so for me than for her, simply because of the way we're wired together. It was people, people, people. There was a lot of counseling involved. There was a couple of conferences that we had spoken at. I was involved in a couple of management meetings, interacting with some of our staff on decision-making and so forth. And so by the time we climbed on the airplane in Orlando, headed home, latter part of January, we were both really weary and anxious to get home. As we were flying into Dallas, Texas, the DFW airport there, the pilot came on the intercom and told us that they had had one of the worst ice storms and cold spells in the Dallas-Fort Worth area that they'd had in years, and it was really a mess down there. Well, you could tell it even when we landed. The plane kind of skidded on the icy runway, and then we got up to the terminal, walked in, and boy, he was right. Nothing was working. The heat was not on in the airport. The clocks were not working. And then if you've ever been to DFW, you know it's a huge place. And you get from one terminal to the other on these little trains. Well, the trains weren't working. And so we found it was a day like this, only it was ice rather than snow. And we were already about 2 or 2.5 hours late. So we found ourselves standing outside in the cold, waiting for a bus to come to take us from where we were to the terminal we needed to get to catch our plane home to Colorado Springs. And I was standing there very quietly at the curb, hands in pockets, looking down at the ground, not saying a word. Carol was next to me, and next to her was a little old lady who was very concerned about whether or not she was going to get home that night and sleep in her own bed. And so Carol began to cheer her up. "Don't worry, sweetheart. Everything is running late. Your plane will be there when you get there. The bus will be here in a minute." On and on, you know, yak, 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 yak. Well, finally this yakking over here began to penetrate my thinking. And I got a little bit irritated with it. And so I pulled my hand out of my pocket. I doubled up my fist. And I just nudged her on the thigh. And that meant, in nonverbal communication, "Shut up." And she got the message. Well, she did shut up. She didn't speak to me the rest of the way home, virtually. Within 10 seconds after I had done it, probably sooner than that, I realized that I had made a terrible mistake. And so I began to try and make amends, and I apologized, and you know, nothing really happened. And finally the bus came and we sat down, and I put my arm around her shoulder and gave her a little squeeze and said, "Honey, I'm sorry, I wasn't thinking about you, I was thinking about me, will you forgive me?" And she kind of grunted. We finally got on the airplane and I apologized 2 or 3 more times. And by the time we got home, everything was okay. There was harmony between us. She had forgiven me. We were at peace with one another. And it was 2 or 2:30 in the morning. You know, we were very, very late. And so we laid our heads on the pillow that night, or that morning, at peace and harmony with each other. Now, most couples, when they go through an experience like that, a conflict situation, and especially when you're tired and you're worn out. Because see, we were tired. We were frustrated because of that dumb situation at the airport. It was totally out of control. We both felt the same way about it. Most couples, when that happens, boy, they are absolutely delighted and so thankful to get it over with. And there is peace between them. That the last thing in the world they want to do is go back and talk about it. Bring it up again. Why in the world would we want to do that? It was so excruciating pain going through it. Why do it again? Well, let me tell you something. If you don't take advantages of situations like that in your relationship to eventually get around in an objective, unemotional way to talk about it and find out what was really going on inside of each other, you'll never get to understand each other. Not really. Not in some really deep areas. I want to come back to that point right there, but let me back up for just a minute and point out one other thing that I think is important in this particular situation as it relates to us. Why was it such an excruciating thing for Carol to forgive me? Some of you may be sitting there thinking, well, boy, she was really tough-nosed on you. I mean, just a little nudge on the thigh, that's no big deal. Why did she take so long to finally give in and forgive? Do you remember when Carol was talking earlier about languages of love? And she gave you 5, and then she gave you 2 more. Do you remember what she said when she was talking about how I express my love to her, what she hears the most? What was it? Acceptance, right? And she's right. She is kind of a nut, and I love her for it. But what was the nudge on the thigh? Lack of acceptance, wasn't it? I mean, pure and simple. Her way of doing what she was doing, her way of coping with the situation that we were in, I didn't appreciate. And the nudge on the thigh told her that. And it just devastated her. It certainly said, I don't love you right now. And it took her a while to get over that. So we need, it's just another indication of why we need to know what our spouse hears. How do they hear love? Okay, let's go back now to talking about this thing. So the next day, what Carol and I did, we'd had a good night's sleep in our own bed. We were home. We sat down and we began to talk about the Dallas-Fort Worth airport experience. What had really happened back there? Why did it explode the way it did? And what was happening? So I began to tell Carol what was going on. My standing there, hands in pockets, looking down at the ground. And what was happening is I was trying to solve this problem that we had that was frustrating and out of control. That's part of my nature. I'm a problem solver at heart. My daughter has told me more than once, Dad, if you didn't have a problem to solve, you'd find one. And she's probably right. And I had found one. I mean, man, this was a humdinger. And I was having an imaginary conversation with the airport manager. And he and I were trying to figure out how to get the planes running back on time, how to get the clocks going, how to get these dumb trains running, how to get the heat back on in the airport. And so I was trying to think through on if I were in his shoes, what would I do? And how would I solve this problem? That helps me cope with that kind of a situation. Carol, on the other hand, felt exactly the same way I did. She was frustrated. The whole situation was out of control. She was cold. She was tired. But her way of coping was entirely different than mine. She was talking up a storm. And so as we talked about that, the conclusion that we came to in terms of her way of coping was what we termed forced cheerfulness. That's the way she copes with that kind of a situation. She inwardly forces herself to be cheerful about a very uncheerful situation. And the way it helps her to handle that in a better way is to cheer somebody else up. And so this little old lady standing next to her was her victim, and she was cheering her up. Well, you know, we probably spent an hour talking about that and going back and forth and asking questions and getting into each other's mind and heart on what was really going on. It helped us understand one another in a far better way than we ever had before, particularly if those same circumstances or situations came up again. And my wife, bless her heart, she can ask some of the toughest questions sometimes. So near the end of that conversation, she said, "Well, sweetheart, next time that happens, what do you want me to do?" Now, gentlemen, if your wife ever asks you that kind of question under similar circumstances, you better think about your answer before you give it, because you're going to have to live with it the rest of your life. So I did. I thought about it, and I gave her what I felt was an absolutely honest answer, and I told her, "Honey, I want you to be yourself." And I really meant that. But you see, now I understood. And she understood. And sure enough, about 3 months later, we found ourselves in a similar situation. I can't remember the details of it, but there I was, standing there, hands in pockets, looking down at the ground, trying to solve this dumb problem we got that was out of control. She was next to me, and next to her was a little 12-year-old boy who was lost. And she started cheering him up and making and encouraging him. "We'll find your parents. Don't worry about that." On, yak, 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 yak. And pretty soon I began to hear this yakking over here. But now, see, I knew what was going on. Huh? That made all the difference in the world. And so I just, Inward, I didn't say anything outwardly, but inwardly I thought to myself, you know, sick of money, have at it. Just... Now let me ask you a question. Putting aside the fist on the thigh, let's take that out of the story for right now. That was wrong. I had to apologize for that because it was a lack of acceptance on my part with regards to it. But take that out of the picture. Whose way of coping with that situation there at the airport was right, and whose way was wrong? Carol's or mine? There isn't a right or wrong, is there? Not wrong, just different, huh? But most of the time when that happens, our tendency, now let's be honest with ourselves, folks, our tendency is to think in our minds about our spouse's way of doing it as wrong rather than just different. Huh? Now, some of you are sitting there and you're saying, well, yeah, but what if he really is wrong? Or what if she really is wrong? Well, if it's an issue of sin, if it's an issue of that really is borderline, then that needs to be dealt with for what it is, other than just different. But we need to be very careful about that and make sure that we are not being judgmental and making a lot more out of it than it really is, other than just different. Huh? So knowing, understanding, adjusting, and accepting. If we could just every week in some situation put those four things into practice, it would take us a long way down the road to really coming to the place where these differences, the opposites that exist between us, no longer cause us to attack each other, but really to grow closer together and attract each other even more. Huh? Let's work on it. Okay, let's see. We've got another hour, don't we? 12:30? What time are we finished? 12:30. Yeah, see, we've got another hour. Let's stand. Carol's going to come up and introduce us to a whole new subject, the area of communication. So let's take a stand, a little break, stretch a little bit. When you sit back down, what I want you to do, or you don't have to sit to do it, but I'd like to have each of you begin to fill in some answers to item one and item two. I feel loved when you, and I express love to you when I. Just in a short phrase, fill that in. I feel loved when you. Now, just two words of caution here. First of all, be very specific. Don't make this theoretical or pie in the sky by and by type stuff or mushy type stuff. Well, maybe a little mushy is okay, but I mean very specific. I feel like, for instance, I feel loved when you catch my eye across the room and wink. Or I feel loved when you walk up behind me in a crowd and put your arm around my shoulder and give me a squeeze. I mean, very concrete stuff like that. Now, the other word of caution is don't preach a sermon on this. We had one guy fill it in, I feel loved when you are on time. Well, the problem was his wife was never on time. So, you know, that didn't really go over well. So don't bring negatives into it. And the same thing on I express love to you when I. Do those two. And then for those of you who can handle a little tougher one. Now, we don't want to... did somebody say, we don't want to start any arguments or fights here this weekend, although I understand we've already started a couple. But tackle number six, if you're able. That's a little tougher one. In what areas are you not understanding your spouse? Now, remember, it says you're not understanding. So you're going to have to be... your own judge on that. And then we want you this afternoon. Now, we're going to give you about 5 or 6 minutes right now to fill in your answers. But then what we want you to do this afternoon after lunch is take a half an hour together just as couples, as a husband and a wife, and talk about this together. If you want to go further in this assignment, feel free. I mean, you've got all afternoon, and depending on what you want to do, but feel free to carry on. But right now, let's just sit down and fill in your answers to those first two. If you want to tackle six, fine. I'll leave that up to you. Right.
To spend some time this afternoon, that's part of the conference. You're here for a Fall in Love conference. And I realize that having a great conflict may not help you to fall more in love, but keep this just as positive as possible and reinforce each other by saying, I feel love when you, and specifically something that they do. It's positive reinforcement. And I feel love when you, and there again, it's something that is a positive reinforcement. So keep it as positive as you possibly can. This, by the way, is a wonderful little exercise to do once every 2 months because you're always expressing wonderful things to one another. Also, I gave the times wrong. We're having lunch at 12:30, and so we'll be at the bookstore, outside the bookstore, about 1 to 1:30. Jim, whom we'd never met, identified himself at a Washington, D.C. airport by holding up a copy of our book, Marriage Takes More Than Love. As we piled into his car, we drove out into a suburb to pick up his wife in order to go to a conference center. As we settled into the back seat, Jim's wife turned to us and said, "How'd y'all meet?" Well, this is one of our very favorite questions, not only to ask people, but to answer. But fortunately, this time, Jack chose the short version. And he said, "We met in college." This lady flushed, looked embarrassed, and then kind of stammered, how did Jim find you at the airport?" And I thought, thank you, Lord, that Jack chose the short version. Communication is difficult. Sometimes we are as confused as the passengers at an airport. They heard this announcement over the loudspeaker. "Will all those Piedmont passengers who have not done so, please do so immediately." True communication involves more than speaking. And it involves more than listening. And it involves far more than the two together. Communication, as we want to start talking about it, is defined as the meeting of meaning. When my meaning meets your understanding across the bridge of words, body postures, tones of voice, all these various methods of communicating, then we can say we have true communication. But friends, this takes working at. And even as I have given you that definition, two kinds of you here have heard it differently. You objective people have thought, yes, when my ideas have been understood with that other person's mind, then we've really communicated. And you subjective people have thought, oh yeah, when my feelings and my emotions have really been communicated to that other person's heart, then we've really got communication. It's sort of like the two of you, and let's say the husband is the objective one, although, as I said, I don't want to put you in a category, but I'm just making the way Jack and I are. That the husband is the objective one, and the wife is the subjective one, and you haven't truly communicated for 3 weeks. And so you decide you're going to go out for dinner and you're going to spend 3 hours really talking in depth. So the first hour, as you're talking, you spend getting caught up with what's happening with the kids and at work and your schedules and your friends. At the end of the first hour, this objective person's communication cup is already 50% full. This subjective person's cup is about 5% full. And so the next hour you talk about problem that he's having with a client and what you want to do in next year's vacation and how you're doing on your financial planning. The end of this hour, his cup, about 85% full. Her cup is about 15. So, the next hour you spend on talking about the lessons that you've been learning in Bible study and what you'd like to happen with the couples that you're working with and some of the difficulties the kids are having in school. Getting down to some feeling level things. So at the end of the 3 hours, his cup is right at the top. Her cup, maybe 45%. And so you go away from that 3 hours, and the husband is thinking, oh, wow, what a wonderful time of in-depth communication. And she's thinking, we've only just begun. And he says, hey, this was so great. We're going to have to do this again next month. And she says, how about tomorrow? Now, what's happened here? Now, for you subjective people, I don't have to tell you what's happened here, but for you objective people, let me explain. You see, in order for a person who is subjective and feeling-oriented to really feel like their communication cup is filled, like they've really talked, they've got to talk about feelings, how they are feeling about a whole lot of things. And this is very difficult for an objective person to do. In fact, a good question for an objective person to ask a subjective person is something like this. On a scale from 1 to 10, with 10 being high, how are you feeling right now in your role as a mother? How are you feeling right now as your role as a wife? How are you feeling as a Christ one? How are you feeling at work? And why? How are you feeling as a friend? How are you feeling as a daughter? All of these things of a feeling nature. And then if you really want to put the cap on the whole thing, take one of those areas and explore how you're feeling about that. Now that's tough for an objective person. Because we all fall into a category of being either a concealer of our feelings or a revealer of our feelings. And yet, friends, someone has said you can't know anyone unless you communicate with them. You can't love anything you don't know. Therefore, the depth of love existing between a husband and a wife will largely depend on the amount and depth of their communication. You've really got a desire to do this. Anyone can learn to communicate. You really can. This is a learned art. It does take work, but it can be learned. Now, granted, there's a lot of acceptance here, too. You see, Jack would fall into the category of being a natural concealer of his feelings. I would fall into the category of being a natural revealer of mine. Now, there are limits in all of these, obviously. There'd be limits to me, because one of the great opponents, enemies, of being able to reveal is ridicule. And so, you know, I can stand up here and I can say to you, you may think that you see a very self-confident woman up here who doesn't mind doing this at all, but you'd be wrong. I'm mentally always hanging onto my husband's coattails. Now, if I feel your acceptance in this, see, I'll peel off another layer. And I'll say, there's some things that I'm struggling with right now in my life. And if I still feel your acceptance, I can keep on revealing. But the minute I feel your, oh, come on, Carol, you're just saying that. Or I feel that resistance, that ridicule, and even in your spirit, I stop. And stop being vulnerable. So ridicule is one of the great enemies of being able to be a revealer. But it can be learned. One man said, who was a real concealer of his feelings, that he realized that he was being selfish. His wife wanted and needed much more of an in-depth kind of communication than he was giving her. And he was the kind of husband who had said, well, she knew that was the way I was when she married me. But he realized that that was selfishness. And selfishness is sin. And so this particular man committed himself to God and to his wife that he was going to learn how to reveal his innermost heart. And he began that process. It took God's help, but he did it. Now, I know Jack didn't go through that process. But somewhere along the line in our marriage, Jack did determine that he was going to learn to be able to communicate to me how he was feeling inside. He'll never be as free and easy with everybody as I can be, but he has learned it to do it with me. And it has deepened our relationship in a wonderful way. Communication is really a complex thing. There are basically six messages involved in the communication process. Don't write these down. I just want to show you how complex it is. What you mean to say, what you actually say, what the other person hears, what the other person thinks he hears, what the other person says about what you said, and what you think the other person said about what you said. You see why it gets complicated. Let me illustrate just in the example of looking at the moon. What did I mean to say? Well, I meant to say that that moon is making me feel very romantic. What I actually said was, oh, isn't that a beautiful moon? What Jack could have heard was, oh, she thinks the moon is bright. And so what he thinks he hears is, yeah, she thinks it's a nice night to take a walk. And so what he said about what I said was, yes, it's bright enough to shoot a golf ball by. And what I think he said about what I said is, I don't feel romantic. Two sentences, we've gone through this whole process and totally missed each other's meaning. Now, friends, this happens often. As we talk to one another, we constantly are communicating through a lot of various ways. Our content, what we say, our tone of voice, and just nonverbal things. Now, I'm going to do a little exercise here to show you what I mean. I want you as couples to just kind of put down in your lap whatever you're doing, and I want you to turn to each other. Turn to each other, cross your arms like this, lean slightly away from each other, and say in a complete monotone, I like you. Monotone, no smiles. Okay? Now, I want you to stay in that position, but say it with just as much expression as you can. I like you. I like you. Okay. Now, unfold your arms and say I like you in a totally non-verbal way. However you want to say I like you without words. Okay? Okay, now what communicated to you the most? See what I'm saying? The words meant nothing, did they, when you said, I like you, and your posture was back. More when you really got some tone in there, but really more when you did it in a non-verbally. So it's important for us to communicate in all these different ways, but more than that, we have got to keep on digging until we come to the true meaning. And in order to do that, my friends, we have constantly got to keep asking each other this question. What do you mean? What are you really saying? Or this is how I'm understanding what you're saying. You see, whether we like it or not, we speak in coded messages often without meaning to. Now, Jack is much better than I am about saying what he means and meaning what he says. But even he fails to do that. For instance, Jack will come in and say, what time is dinner? Now, wouldn't you think that was a very simple question. Most of you wise would say, oh, Jack's hungry, I better hurry up and get something on the table. But see, what Jack is really saying is, do I have time to exercise before dinner? And if I don't know that, here I am hurrying up dinner when he wants it delayed. We spent a day with a couple friends of ours, and as we were ending the day, she said, it's 5 o'clock. Well, no, wasn't that interesting? We all had watches. We all knew it was 5 o'clock. But we had been talking about this very thing, so I kind of laughed, and I turned to her, and I says, okay, Jeannie, what are you really saying? Well, what Jeannie was really saying was, do I have time to go home and check on the children before we go out to dinner? She would have gone the whole evening frustrated if I hadn't have asked. Now, I'm not sure why we don't feel free to just ask what we're really asking. But especially we wives are very good at projecting into our husbands what a meaning that is often not there. Or we expect them to know what we're thinking. I have a dear friend who has 4 little stair steps and children. And so when her husband, children that are just like, no, no, no. And so when her husband comes home from work, she's ready to collapse. And so she wants him very much to take charge of the children while she gets dinner on the table. And, but he comes in and flops down on the Davenport and picks up the paper and just tunes everything out. So she takes that as long as she can, and finally she goes over to him, pokes her head between him and the paper, and she says, pick a kid, any kid. And he doesn't really appreciate that too much, so he gets a little upset, and they go through this little thing. Well, as my friend was telling me this, I said, well, what would your husband do if you greeted him at the door and asked him to watch the children while you get dinner on the table? And she said, oh, he would do it. And I said, well, then why don't you ask him? What did she say, wives? He should know. Of course. Oh, friends, we're so unfair. 41 years we've been married, and my husband still says, honey, I can't read your mind. And I think by now you should. Jack can't read my mind. We're two distinct individuals. And I need to be vulnerable enough, to be humble enough, to be honest enough, to say, hey, I just need a hug. He doesn't know when I need a hug. Hey, I just need a little of your time. I just need you to hold me. I just need. But if we don't, we have got to keep saying, this is how I'm understanding what you're really saying. Or what do you mean? Now, I realize in this audience there are some of you who are threatened by that question, what do you mean? And I have heard husbands and wives say, well, you should know what I mean, and get quite angry at that question. And friends, my prayer would be that God would help you to have the kind of maturity that you can accept that kind of question. Because we need to ask it often to get down where we're really living. But if you have a spouse who is threatened by that kind of question, then what you may need to work on is to go through a whole week without asking a question, but rather stating what you're trying to get at as a statement instead of a question. What do I mean? Well, Dave Augsburger says in his little book, Caring Enough to Confront, this is a very good exercise to try. And I tried it 1 week. It just about killed me, but I tried it. Instead of saying, what's the matter, if your husband comes in very down in the mouth, state it as a statement. Say, I get the feeling that you're really discouraged about something. Well, yeah, I am. Well, I wonder if it could be that your boss really got on your back today. No, you're not asking questions, you're making statements. It takes real practice, but it really does work. Until your mate gets to the place where they can handle that question, what do you mean? Or you're restating it in saying, you know, I get the feeling that this could be a really upsetting thing for you, and you're restating what they said. That's called the feedback technique, and we need to work at it continually. Tremendous little verse in Ephesians 4:15 is one that we should filter our words through. It talks about not being immature children, and then this little phrase, but rather speaking the truth in love. We are to grow up in unto Him who is the head, even Christ. Oh, my friends, if we could just filter our words through that little phrase, speaking the truth in love. So often we're so brutally honest and frank that we're not kind, we're not loving. Or we can be so, try to be so loving that we're not honest. We're not truthful. Now forever, we've got to handle the negatives in our relationship. And Jack will be speaking about conflict tomorrow morning. But for every negative, friends, there ought to be 20 positives. That the whole atmosphere over our relationship is positive, reinforcement, loving. And that's another thing where we need to really work at it. Speaking the truth in love. The Old Testament in Proverbs 3:3-6 in the Living Bible puts it this way. Never forget to be truthful and kind. Hold these virtues tightly. Write them deep within your heart. If you want favor with both God and man and a reputation for good judgment and common sense, then trust the Lord completely. Don't ever trust yourself. In everything you do, put God first, and He will direct you and crown your efforts with success, including this last one, being truthful and kind. Now, for a few years ago, we were hearing a lot about the fact that we ought to be totally transparent with one another. I hope that you have thought through on that one. Friends, a lot of the thoughts that pop into my head are not kind. And they're going to be different the next minute. You know, I could say, I don't like that expression you've got on your face right now. Well, how stupid to say that, to just let it all pop out. Experts used to tell us, they're getting away from that a little bit now, but they used to tell us that that was the way to be intimate, to have intimacy. And I say baloney. Because a lot of the things that go through my mind are nothing but sin, and I need to confess them to God and then love my husband. Now, another great enemy of the communication process is the fact that we are simply too busy. You heard the story maybe of the husband who had his hand on the television knob, and he turned to his wife and he says, "Now, is there anything you want to say to me before football season starts?" Some wives don't laugh at that one. You know, if we're too busy for each other to really communicate, we're too busy. And I think that there are times in our lives, and we Christ ones can be most guilty of this, because there are so many good things out there that we want to do. And so the good becomes the enemy of the best in our lives. Our relationship with God first, and then our relationship with our spouses. And sometimes I have to sit down with the Lord and a pencil and paper and list everything I'm involved in. And then I have to pray in the light of Psalm 139:23-24, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any," one translation says, "anxious ways in me, or a wicked way in me." And I ask the Lord to start listing the things that I've got in my piece of paper as I've listed everything that I'm involved in. And then for the Lord to help me put those in priority. And then to whack off the last five. So that I'll be able to say yes to what's really important. Someone has said maturity is knowing when to say yes and when to say no and when to say whoopee. And I like that. But we're simply too busy. Jack and I had the great privilege of sitting under Dr. Norman Wright for a day. And I think of Dr. Norman Wright as being Mr. Marriage Counselor. He's written about 50 books on marriage, and he teaches a course in marriage out at in California. And he does private counseling. And Dr. Wright took an engaged couple with their permission and interviewed them, counseled them, in front of a few of us. And he asked this engaged couple, he says, what makes you think you're going to make it? And this engaged couple said all the things that you and I would have said. Oh, we really love each other. And Dr. Wright said, yes, what else? Oh, we're really committed to this relationship. Yes, what else? Oh, we really feel this is God's will. Yes, what else? No, well, he went until they didn't have anything more to say. And then he said, you know, 90% of the couples that I get in my office that are ready to get divorced have said the same things you have. What makes you think you're going to make it? Well, they didn't have anything further to say. And he said, let me give you two things that may help you have a marathon marriage. Marriage for the long haul. And these were the two things that he suggested to them. He said, first of all, put into your budget time and money for a marriage seminar every year. Jack and I about fell off our chairs. We give them, but we never would have said that. But what was he saying? Make it priority. Get some kind of help. Keep getting input. Grow. And then he said, secondly, never stop dating. Jack and I wanted to go, yay! Because we've been saying that. We've been dating for longer than 41 years. We've been dating for 44 years. And a date to us is not a double date. Mm-mm. It's Jack and me. Someplace away from the house. Every week. That's what Dr. Wright said. Every week. Why? Well, because you think to talk about things when you're away from the house that you never think to talk about at home. And again, you're making it priority. But it takes time. Now, granted, you with lots of little children or busy, busy schedules, you fight for this time. And we fight for this time. But it's priority. A few minutes every day in depth communication and then a date once a week. And that has helped us not only survive, but grow. But it takes time. And then it takes a commitment not to use silence as a tool against the other. Withdrawing and refusing to talk. Silence can be used as a tool. You realize that, I think. And this must not be. Psychologists tell us that 40% of troubled marriages are characterized by the silent husband. But wives can pull this little trick too. We have got to commit ourselves to God that we won't use this tactic of silence used as a tool. And then we have got to commit ourselves to staying open to one another and to keep on asking, even when we're tired and not wanting to ask, but just to keep going deeper. And I'm just going to give you one illustration, and it happened right here in the Great Hall. The last time we gave a marriage seminar like this, 3 years ago. As we told you last night, when I get excited and stimulated and so on, I just start talking faster and faster. I have to be very careful about coffee at night, or I blah, 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 you know. Well, 3 years ago when we gave the seminar, we'd had a woman's staff conference beforehand, and it was friends of mine, and I just was really revved up. And then we had this conference, which is always rather intimidating to me. You know, this great hall is still intimidating to me. And all these wonderful people. And I just felt myself, my motor, just going faster and faster and faster. And then we sat down with five or six couples who didn't know each other at dinner, and Carol's little Miss Hospitality button got pushed, and she was just, you know, asking everybody questions and going on and on. In the middle of dinner, I felt a hand on my knee. Not a fist on my thigh, but a hand on my knee. In nonverbal communication, my husband was saying, "Honey, simmer down." I tried. Next day, speaking, here I am, going again. Several times during the day, Jack would lean over to me and say, "Honey, simmer down." I tried. Got to our room that night. Both dead tired. I put my arms around Jack and I said, "Honey, do you love me?" Husbands, if your wives ever ask you that question and you've been married more than 5 weeks, realize that's not the real question, okay? Jack said, "Why, of course I love you." And I said, "Well, I need that assurance right now." And he said, "Well, for what reason?" And I said, "Well, sometimes I guess I feel like you love me, but I'm not always sure you like me." And he said, "Well, what has given you that impression? What have I done to make you feel that way?" Now, about this time, I'm feeling very stupid. And I'm tired, and I'm thinking, "Oh, let's forget this. It isn't important anyway." But see, I was committed to let him keep asking me if he would, and he did, until we got way down where I was living. And so I said, "Well, several times today you've told me to quiet down." And he said, "But honey, you've been hyper all day. I've been trying to help you." And I said, "Well, I think I know that, but when it's several times, I think that you can't like me when I'm that way." And he said, "But you need to accept the fact that the reason is I want to help you." Get all those facts? Did you get all those feelings? I sighed and I said, "My head does, but my heart doesn't always." And he gave me a big hug and he said, "Honey, I love you and I like you." And with that, we went to bed. I got up and I wrote that conversation down 30 minutes later when this was going on, just because I realized that we had done something right. And we don't always. Because Jack, as tired as he was, kept on digging. And as tired as I was, I kept on answering. That's the vulnerability that we need, my friends. That's the acceptance that we need, and the really going to understand one another. We are after way more than the cliche type surface communication, my mouth to your ear. And we're after more than my mind to your mind, which is the facts and ideas. And we're after way more even than my heart to your heart, which gets down to the feelings and emotions. But our goal is my soul to your soul. Mm-hmm. He's surprised. Why not? We've just got about 10 minutes more, so why don't you, pardon? Two or three things, and then that's all. Okay, don't stand up then.
Thanks, hon. That was great. I just want to add one other thing to something that Carol mentioned that we have run into from time to time, and that has to do with what Dr. Wright told this couple to do every year, two things to do every year, and one was attend a marriage seminar every year. Well, that happened, we attended that seminar probably 5 years ago. And after that, we began to talk about it, but we found ourselves in some situations where the big question in the minds of the people was, how in the world can we do that? There's nothing available. I mean, here in the United States, that's not a problem. You can always find some place to go once a year for a weekend to get away and hear something new and fresh on how to handle your marriage better. But in Africa and out certain places out in East Asia, that just is not possible. So we've come up with a couple of ideas that you could use too. Not only the people in Kenya and Ghana and East Malaysia, but you could use too. And that is simply this. Okay, so you don't have maybe the time or the money to travel like some of you have to a weekend like this, but you could take a short weekend, a Friday night maybe and a Saturday, just one night overnight at a hotel or motel near your home, get a babysitter for the kids, and take along a good book on marriage that you have both been wanting to read, and take it along with you and read it during the weekend out loud together. In other words, the wife read a chapter, a part of a chapter, and then talk about that, and then the husband reads some out loud and talk about that, and just spend a good, not all the time, but a good deal of the time doing that for the time that you've got there in the motel. And the talking out loud and discussing the topics that you read in the book will be a pretty good little marriage seminar on your own. But it will help accomplish a good many of the same things as coming to a deal like this. Another option to that would be to take a series of tapes, either videotapes or audio tapes. If you've got a good set of videotapes, why take your VCR along with you, plug it up to the TV in the motel and have at it and watch for a while and then stop and talk and have some coffee and rolls and just give yourselves, expose yourselves to some new thoughts and ideas and have a little marriage seminar that way. Now, we feel so strongly about that idea that we ourselves make an effort to go to one seminar every year. That's our goal. Not necessarily just marriage, but something in some way related that will help us in our own lives personally, or will help us in some aspect of our ministry. And we don't always succeed at it, but just about every year we're away for a weekend or a few days at a seminar. Just recently, back last early part of September, we were back in Philadelphia for a four-day seminar on what is called the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, which is a personality evaluation type thing. And it was tremendously helpful to us just in our own lives and understanding ourselves and one another, but also it's going to be tremendously helpful in our ministry with couples to help them understand themselves and one another. In fact, we're in the process of taking that and putting it together and working out a whole new seminar with it that we could give in a couple of evenings. So let us encourage you to do that. Keep dating, and as Carol said, put into your budget time and money to get to some kind of a marriage weekend. Even if you have to invent your own, do it every year.